Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today, showman Hershey Felder brings Irving Berlin to life in his one-man show at Berkeley Rep. You'll hear about the Robert Lepage play about Miles Davis and Jean Cocteau at ACT, Needles and Opium, from the two stars of the show, Olivier Nauman and Wellesley Robertson III. More on the San Francisco International Film Festival with senior programmer Rod Armstrong and filmmaker Travis Matthews. And conductor Martin West returns to update us on the latest SF Ballet productions. Stay with us. The incomparable voice of Ethel Merman in There's No Business Like Show Business. Music of Irving Berlin to open this segment of Open Air as showman Hershey Felder brings the composer to life in a one-man show at Berkeley Rep that combines Hershey's blend of musical biography, piano virtuosity, and character study that has earned him accolades for similar portrayals of George Gershwin, Leonard Bernstein, Beethoven, and Chopin over the past 20 years for some 4,500 performances around the world. Hershey has been a scholar in residence at Harvard and runs his own full-service production company to bring these and other shows to life, and such a pleasure to welcome him back to our airwaves. Hi, Hershey.
Thank you, David. It's so nice to see you, and nice new digs.
We're working on it.
Congratulations, man.
We're getting there.
Yeah, out of the trailers and into the big time. I love it.
Now we just need a little branding. We're going to get some people in to make our walls look pretty.
That's great. Wonderful. It's beautiful. Thank you for having me.
Apologies again for not having a piano here. I would love to have you here once we, I think we have room for a baby grand in here.
In the next renovation.
Or the next donation to KLW.org. What would you like, a Kauai or a Steinway?
Steinway artist. So.
Well, talk to them. You're a Steinway artist.
I know what phone call I'm going to make as soon as I leave. It's going to work out.
Okay. Well, then you'll be booked again. Well, just looking at the catalog of songs of Irving Berlin is the very definition of the Great American Songbook. We could spend an hour just reading the titles of some 1,500 songs this man wrote. But just to refresh people's mind, all from the pen of Irving Berlin, what we just heard, Blue Skies, Cheek to Cheek, Alexander's Ragtime Band, Putting on the Ritz, There's No Business Like Show Business, Easter Parade, White Christmas, God Bless America, God Bless Irving Berlin, for gosh sake.
Well, 232 top 10 hits, 25 number ones, which is really a remarkable accomplishment. 1,500 songs, 60 years leading the American voice, the American sound. And then all of a sudden come the 1950s and Elvis shows up and that's the end of that. So he...
Good run, though, for gosh sake.
Well, an incredible run. But one can imagine when that happened, he was 75 years old. And he still had 26 years left because he lived till he was 101. So just imagine when you're still creative, you're full of beans, full of energy, but the world doesn't want to hear you as a leader anymore. What do you do? He became a complete recluse.
Did he really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
He lived in his home, didn't see anybody for the large part of 26 years. And people thought he was angry and was just a curmudgeon and he was an awful person. But in fact, that's not the case at all. And that was a lot of the discovery of this character and finding out about him, was that he felt that the world had passed him by.
I was going to say this is a live biopic that you're delivering to us that I'm sure delves into his personal life as well as his public persona. Any dirt revealed, or we just go an all-American hero type thing here?
Well, I'll turn to the director for the dirt. Trevor Hay is here with me. So is there any dirt?
You want dirt on Irving or dirt on Hershey?
Oh, no. Great.
Plenty of both.
All right. It's enough from the director now.
Something wrong with my mic.
No. Well, I don't know. What do you think? I don't think there is.
Welcome, really, Trevor Hay,
you know,
by the way. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, David. He's a rare bird in the fact that there wasn't really a lot of dirt. He was a shrewd businessman. He was competitive. But to a person, they would say that he had a ton of integrity. He was a true patriot. He was a great artist. He supported, there's a great story of he had a young assistant, a musical secretary, who worked for him, and within a few days, he told the guy to get lost, that he was too good, and that he needed to make his own way, and it was George Gershwin. It was that kind of, he was competitive.
Maybe
he'll
be something someday, kid.
Competitive, but also said, you're not a musical secretary, you need to go compose, you need to do that. And, he gave all the rights and royalties to God Bless America to the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts of America. In perpetuities. It's been over, millions of dollars now. Probably hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, since 1938.
The whole
life. Donated
in
1938.
Well, there's an interesting story about the creation of God Bless America. Maybe you'll share it with us. It is actually composed 20 years before Kate Smith ever sung it.
Well, it wasn't composed for her. It was composed for the First World War. And what is interesting about it is that he had a musical secretary, Harry Ruby, and he would play songs for his musical secretaries, kind of like... Victor Hugo would write for his maid and ask the maid, what do you think? And the maid would say, yeah, it's not so good. And so this musical secretary said to him, Irving, it's a terrible song. It's too patriotic. Nobody wants to hear anything patriotic anymore. So he stuffed it away in the trunk. Then Kate Smith called looking for a song for Armistice Day in 38.
20th anniversary.
Yeah, 20. That's right. And so he pulled the song out of the trunk and he gave it to her. And, of course, turned it into God Bless America. But I was so touched to really find out that he never took a cent for it. So, you go to a baseball game in Boston, for instance, 34,000 people are singing God Bless America. And all the royalties have gone to Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. But what is interesting is he lived so long, and it's so part of our fabric that we actually think it's a folk song. Many people are shocked to discover that Irving Berlin wrote God Bless America.
Wow, and it's got such a beautiful verse that not everyone hears all the time. When the storm clouds gather.
Well, sing, David.
I don't know the rest, but you know it. Come on. Give it to us. Give us the verse.
When the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to our land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair as we raise our voices in a solemn prayer.
Everyone, we got a studio full of people here.
God bless. Wait a minute. We have a Brit here. I don't think it works for him. Oh, I have to tell you, because we've got a Brit. You're a Brit here. Where are you from, Brit? Okay, you're from Manchester.
Martin
All right.
West, composer.
Okay,
Martin.
Oh, lovely. Nice to meet you. So I was at the Duchess Theatre in London, and I was actually playing Gershwin, in the Rhapsody and everything. It's a real thing. So at the end of it, somehow we asked one audience if they could sing along, and this was at the time when George Bush had just taken over, had become president. And so
taken over is right.
Yeah. I asked the audience at the end of this, it was one of those encore things. I said, okay, we'll sing whatever you like to sing. And a woman stood up from the back. I don't know, she must have been a patriot or something. She said, I'd like to sing God Bless America. And I said, no problem when we do an Irving Berlin show, fine, but this is a Gershwin show, so God Bless America won't do. And then one woman, she says, no, but I'd like to sing God Bless America. And a woman in the second round turned around and said, darling, not here.
And she probably said, Hershey, give me one of them chocolate bars of yours.
It was one of those memorable moments. But people really think that is the fabric of the nation. Some of the songs he wrote that people don't know it came from him. And that's really a great testimony. It's also, he's one of the fellows who actually outlived his own rights. And he outlived the Alexander's Ragtime Band went to the public domain while he was still alive.
Wow.
That's such a rare occasion.
Well, we were speaking earlier about his business acumen, and was he one of the co-founders of ASCAP, or just
he was original board. He was one of the founders of ASCAP.
Yeah,
and which is a remarkable thing. And you know, for a man who couldn't read a note of music. And it was interesting because, as you know, I come from the world of Beethoven, Chopin, Bernstein, and all this, as we've talked before. This was totally anathema to anything I was going to do. And it was his daughters, actually, who said to me, you know, we know of your other work. We'd love to do this. I said, he was a jingle writer. Totally not for me. You know, what did he write? Like
Hershey,
White Christmas.
Hershey.
And then I went to study. Well, it was just ignorance and arrogance. But then I went to study his life, and I realized this was a man who was really a great man. His accomplishments, I mean, if you think of just his construction accomplishments, at 31 years old, he built the Music Box Theater in New York.
Mm.
That is a really remarkable thing, just what he had to go through to do that, and all the genius. But he didn't write a note of music. And, you know, coming from the world I come from, the snobbery, well, if you can't do that, you can't possibly be serious. But he dictated every note and every harmony because he heard perfectly.
Mm.
And that is what is remarkable. So he basically had the same gift that Mozart had without the education that went along with it.
He also had a very special piano that helped him compose. Tell us about his special piano.
Well, in those days it would have been special. Today, nobody can do that. And that he had a transposing piano. But unlike today where you push a button and the whole thing goes somewhere else, he actually had a lever on his piano that moved the entire keyboard up and down. And I think there are three or four of them. One is in the Smithsonian. One is in the Netherlands, in fact, because he took Starship Line or something. And so the museum that was created there where he left on the boat, they have one of the pianos. And then every now and then I get a letter from somebody in the audience. I have Irving Berlin's piano. You should come. My father wants to sell it for $1 million. But you know, that kind of thing. But we find them all over. So
I thought it was also because he only wanted to play, for the most part, on the black notes to get his melodies out. Is that a
I'm not sure it's
story?
Because he wanted to play, but I think it's more because it's the only place he could play. And I do have a funny bit in the show. He says he chooses the black notes to play on because they stick out. They're much easier to find. You know, so... but he did play in F sharp. But then again, no matter when you look at him, there's a couple of videos of him playing. He gets a white note here or there, and so you know he could actually get around the keyboard.
So again, this amazing catalog of his works. Are you still personally discovering Irving Berlin songs, or have you heard them all?
Oh, at some point in the first year of studying this, I went through about 1,000 of them to see what known and what unknown would fit the show. And I think between Trevor and I, we managed to create a through line of 26 songs that captures both the known and the unknown, and the very much so known but unknown origin. I'm assuming, because you're a musician, you know the origin of Supper Time, but maybe you don't.
I don't.
Good. Excellent. Then it makes
I have to come to the show?
Well, there's that. But I'll give it here because, you know, Supper Time, you know, cooking the supper, where's my husband, and so on and so forth. It sounds like a woman who's been jilted by her man.
Actually, I've sung that song myself. So,
and you don't know the origins?
I don't know where my husband is.
Okay. Well, okay. It's a good number then. You can keep on singing it. So 1933, As Thousands Cheer at the Music Box Theater. And it's ripped directly from the Daily Headlines. They're doing all kinds of comedy numbers, and they realize something has happened in America that they have to deal with. And Ethel Waters is his first African-American star, who he puts up in a starring role, never been done on Broadway before with a headliner. He has to give her something serious. Well, there had been 24 lynchings that year. Supper Time is actually written for Ethel Waters about a woman who doesn't know what she's going to tell her children because her man is not coming home for supper that evening.
Wow.
And, you know, this was not a time where in 1933 this was social climbing. Oh, I'm going to do a number about African Americans. God, I'm going to get popular in the news business. This was somebody who had a real commitment to what was right. And in 1933 he did that. And critics got after him. He says, has no place in a show like this. And he said, it stays. And it became, of course, a famous song. And this is way before Strange Fruit, a long time before Strange
Fruit. Well, it's going to make for a perfect segue to our next act, so to speak, because we're going to be talking about Louis Armstrong and the reception that he had in Paris versus what other black musicians had in Paris versus what they had in their own home turf of the United States.
It's a fascinating story. Thank you for having us.
No, of course. Trevor, anything you need to add to how you've reined him in?
It's impossible. It's impossible. He's a machine. But come out to Berkeley. It's a lot of fun.
The show runs through
the 30th of April.
The end of the month. Berkeley Repertory www.ethelmerman.org for more information and tickets. We're going to go out with What'll I Do and Linda Ronstadt singing. Give us a little background for that tune.
This was actually written just after Irving's mother died. I know that's a little creepy. He's writing a love song to his mother. But actually it was about him being alone. And there is one line, although it's a romantic piece, there is one line in there that does reference what he did do to his mother. And that was he gave her a photograph that she had taken of, and he kept it on his nightstand. This is a photograph taken of her in the garden. He kept this photograph after she passed on his nightstand for the rest of his life. And that come from there, the line, what'll I do about the photograph?
And thanks for coming in, Margie.
Thank you. Right.
Trevor, thanks.
Thanks, David.
Have a great run.
You must go your way and I must go mine. But now that our love dreams have ended, what'll I do?
Linda Ronstadt singing the great tune What'll I Do of Irving Berlin. Hershey Felder as Irving Berlin at Berkeley Rep. Well, now through April 23rd, ACT is presenting the visually stunning production of Needles and Opium, written and directed by Robert Lepage, one of the most innovative creative minds in the performing arts today. It's for two actors and an army of behind-the-scenes supporting crew that assist the actors as they make their way around, under, and on top of a three-dimensional cube that seems to defy the laws of gravity. Bringing the characters to life are Olivier Normand as the main character, Robert, who is in Paris to narrate a documentary about Miles Davis, and Wellesley Robertson III, who plays the legendary trumpeter. Olivier is also inhabits the persona of Jean Cocteau, the French writer, designer, playwright, artist, filmmaker, whose post-New York visit Letter to Americans figures prominently in the storyline. We're taken on an arresting journey of Cocteau to New York and Miles to Paris in the late 1940s through amazing projections and these two gravity-defying actors. Olivier Normand is a graduate of the Conservatoire d'Art Dramatique de Québec and has performed on all of Quebec City's stages and many other stages. He's well-versed in the work of Robert Lepage, having played lead roles in Lepage's Playing Cards, Spades, and others for Ex Machina. Olivier is also a director, and he teaches at L'École de Cirque de Québec. Next year, he'll be directing Le Son de Nuit d'été, or Midsummer Night's Dream, in co-production with Théâtre du Trident and Flip Fabrique. How'd I do on my French there,
yeah,
Olivier?
Quite good. Quite good.
I think I got a little bit left from my grandma. I don't know. Wellesley Robertson III, as Miles Davis, has background in gymnastics, breakdance, and acrobatics, all of which I'm sure has come in handy in tackling this unique role of Miles Davis in this Lepage production. He's a member of the Toronto-based performance group Abstract Breaking System, or is that Abstract Breaking Systems? No, I think in Toronto they don't speak so much that way. And has toured with such groups as Cirque Sublime on their cross-Canada tour of their show Adamo and Circus Orange on their tour to Bahrain. That must have been something. Welcome to you, Wellesley.
Thank you.
Well, maybe it should be only Olivier that speaks, because you only speak through Miles' trumpet. So I'm going to shut your mic off right now.
All right. It was a pleasure. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, that's what's unique about the show, is that Olivier's inhabiting several roles, Jean Cocteau, as well as Robert, who's kind of like Robert Lepage. We'll talk about that in a minute. Now, I know that Miles' recordings, Wellesley, are used throughout the show, but do we ever hear you playing? Do you play the trumpet? Do we want to hear you?
I don't know if you really want to hear me play, but it's kind of the magic that happens when you see the show, because the way the sound comes from the stage, it's very hypnotizing, and it does throw people for a loop. It is where the sound's coming from. So.
It is. I mean, not only visually, but orally stunning. And you're right. It looks like, because I wasn't far from the stage. I was like, is he playing? Has he got a speaker somewhere nearby?
Yeah.
It's really brilliantly done. Now, Robert, I mentioned your double duty as Robert and Jean Cocteau. I understand that Lepage's productions, even after they open, kind of undergo a process of evolution. But in this case, I can't imagine that would be possible, given all the various physical planes you guys are operating on.
Well, in fact, this play was a remount of a play that he did in the 1990s.
Where he acted as both characters,
and Miles Davis was always a shadow played by either a technician or Robert himself. So when they did the remount of the play 3 years ago, Wesley was in the remount, they used different sets to see how it was going to work, and they cut scenes and they did other things. But Wesley, you know more about it because you were there from the very beginning.
Yeah, it was neat to see how we evolved, because the rehearsal process, it wasn't the cube itself. It was two basically wood makeups of the cube in two extremes, and a lot of the rehearsing was working on the cube and playing with the cube, and we did a couple reads, and you know, there were scenes that were moved or cut or whatnot, but it was really neat to be able to work with that, and then go away, then come back and work with a cube that didn't have any of the doors or beds opening up, but it still moved. And then in a third process, when the cube was alive and it had all the bells and whistles, and it was really neat to play with that.
Well, I'll echo what the Boston Globe said, simply hypnotizing, because it really is extraordinary the way you guys are almost in outer space at times, floating down or sliding down the set, and then you're on a different plane entirely in a different city.
Mm-hmm.
And the projections just make this so incredibly crisp and clear. It's not just like a slide projection.
Right.
It's really, really cutting-edge technology that's going on here. Also, given the extraordinary stage movements, the flying, the twisting, the sliding, are there understudies at the ready, just in case a twist or a turn goes the wrong way?
No.
That's all, folks.
Yeah.
It's basically don't get hurt and, and enjoy it. Yeah.
Yeah. Olivia, I understand you've been working with Lepage for some time now. When did your association with your fellow Quebecois ami begin?
We did a show that was called Playing Cards 4 years ago. So it was a completely different show with a circular stage, and all the actors were under the stage, in fact. So we created the show in Germany, and then we toured in Brazil and in Denmark and Quebec also, and in France. So we worked as co-writers on the show, me and the six other actors and Robert, for like a year and a half and 2 years. And then I took over the part in Needles and Opium only last fall. There was another actor who was playing the part, Marc Labrèche. So you've been touring, guys, for like 2-3 years. And then last fall, last July, I went in London for 5 days to learn the part. And then I opened in France in October, and that's it. So, and usually I only did the play in French normally. So I did it in English for the first time 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C. And then I did it in San Francisco in English. So usually I don't play in English, act in English at all.
Well, you were marvelous. Right? Congratulations. I know of Lepage works primarily through his work in the world of opera, staging a magnificent and somewhat controversial Ring cycle for the Met back in 2010, and then more recently a visually stunning La Mort du Loin, also at the Met, the opera by Kaija Saariaho. So he's cutting-edge designer, just a brain right now that is just so wonderful to witness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's really fun to work in this way, because in the rehearsal process, whether it was in Needles and Opium or Playing Cards, the set designer is in the rehearsal room and the sound designer is there and the writer is there. So everybody's there. So every aspect of the show goes side by side. So you can work on the text, but then the set influences the narration of the text and the sound comes in. So it's really it's not a usual process where you do a reading and then you rehearse for like 5 weeks and then the set comes in. Everything goes at the same time.
The inspiration for the show comes from an odd coincidence involving a Paris hotel room in Robert Lepage, one of the key settings of the play. Talk to us about the Robert character, which is really Lepage, who performed both roles, as we mentioned, back when the work premiered in 91.
Well, it's the story is quite simple, but it's really beautiful because it is so simple and universal, and it reflects with the story of Miles Davis and Jean Cocteau. It's the story about a guy, basically, who goes through a heartbreak, and he has to go in Paris to narrate a documentary film about Miles Davis, but he doesn't want to be there, and so he's kind of lost in Paris, and the only things he can grab on are recordings of Miles Davis and a small book that Jean Cocteau wrote that's called A Letter to Americans, where he talks about his visit to New York. So it's kind of the French character going to New York and the American character going to France. So we follow Robert through this. He's having a hard time going through his heartbreak and tries to find answers, and he thinks, well, I'm not a genius as Miles Davis, and I'm not a genius as Jean Cocteau, so what do I do with my pain if I cannot create something beautiful out of it?
And the hotel room itself figures prominently in both Robert Lepage's life when he went to Paris, and tell us about the odd coincidence about that hotel room.
In Robert's work, he always finds a coincidence that's like, this cannot happen, but it happens all the time. So this room in Hotel La Louisiane, it's the actual room where he went one day, and this is a room where Miles Davis went, and Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir had this room for a while, and Juliette Gréco, Miles Davis's lover, was there for a time. So all the action, all the coincidences, like, converge into this room.
Bizarre and wonderful. Now, Opium figures prominently in this play, and the two artists, Cocteau and Davis, with very different reactions to it. Cocteau, it's revealed, it's an inspiration for him. It's helping him in his creative mind. What for Miles, it was absolutely debilitating. Yeah. It took away his creative spirit.
Yeah. But it's like two sides. The only scene where Wesley and me are together on stage is kind of a dreamy scene where Jean Cocteau talks to Miles Davis about what does opium do and what kind of state of mind you're in and what's going to happen to you if you keep on doing this drug thing. So it's interesting because they never met, in fact, but they meet in this hotel room in the show.
And it's neat because that scene, I mean, you do see the two extremes of what happens. I mean, you have Jean Cocteau who's just talking about his influence with opium, and then you have, you know, just before, you have Miles Davis who basically just chased the dragon, so to speak, and you know, he's in his own state, so you see the effect that it had on him.
Tell me about your preparation for the Miles role.
It was,
you were a fan of Miles' work or know much about him before this?
No, it was neat because I was approached and asked, because I was working on two of Robert's operas before. So I was working on Le Rossignol, The Nightingale, which was my first foray into his work and opera itself with a pool. And I also did The Tempest as well. And then he approached me and asked, you know, told me he's going to be doing a remount. Would I be interested? And I said, yeah. But it's interesting finding the inspiration for what was going on, because the role, that it's basically taking you on a journey of loss and heartache, not necessarily going through all that myself, but, you know, trying to find out what would we have to grab onto and what would it be like being hurt that badly, or, you know, losing something or not feeling the same as you were. You know, you're in one space and then all of a sudden you're ripped out and taken somewhere else, and you're not treated the same, and nothing is as what it used to be.
Well, part of that backstory is the story of black American artists, yeah, in Paris and their reception in Paris versus the way they were treated in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing to you're somewhere and you're treated well, and you go back home, and you're almost a second class citizen, maybe even third, and it's not there, and you long for that feeling, and you know that it's out there, but back home where it's home, it's not, you're not treated like that.
So. Which brings us to the other parallel of Jean Cocteau's expat experience of his visit to New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because what he says is, I've only been in New York for 20 days, but sometimes from a stranger's look, the first glance that you see a face that you've seen for the first time, maybe you have another perspective. So that's why he writes this letter to Americans, and he tried to just to tell them what he has seen is in this country and is in his short visit to New York.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Olivier Normand, who's portraying Jean Cocteau and the character Robert in Needles and Opium, and Wellesley Robertson III, who plays Miles Davis. Now, I said in the intro that the work is for two actors, but in fact, a third kind of helps out in one very famous scene that's created from recreated from a Life magazine shoot. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there was this really famous photo shoot of Life magazine where you see Jean Cocteau with like four arms, and he's holding a cigarette and drinking eating a sandwich and everything. So with Marie-Lou, who's the prop manager of the show, she also plays Juliette Gréco in a scene with Wesley. So we do this really choreography where I hold a cigarette and she lights it up and she gives me a sandwich and then I move my arm and then I write. And it's really fun to do. And it's quite cartoonish, in fact.
It's really a bizarre recreation. Now, Lepage writes of the unique feeling of what it means to be Quebecois, not French, not Canadian, not English, and the great flood of creativity that comes from that particular slice of the world. Do you feel that as well?
It's like having that's why I think there's a French character in the show and an American character. It's like having a foot in each continent, so you're a little bit French and from Europe and a little bit American too. So it's like being a little bit of both. Yeah.
And how about you, Wellesley?
It's really neat because those are some of my favorite scenes, just to see the dynamics between, you know, being English Canadian, well, I'd say a Francophile, you know, growing up in the French immersion system, and, you know, speaking French and seeing and learning. You get to see everything that's going on, and you feel the creativity that's going on, and, you know, to be able to relate to some of the French Canadian isms that are happening, and in contrast with English Canada, so it's really neat to see.
Where does this go from here? I mean, ACT must be one stop. Is it going on at some other point?
This is the end of the season for now. So next year, I think we're going to continue touring in Europe, but it's really nice to be for a whole month in San Francisco, really, because we're here until the 23rd of April 23rd. So it's nice to have a long run.
ACT.sf.org for more information for tickets through the 23rd of this month. Needles and Opium. Happens to be Jerry Mulligan's birthday today, a longtime collaborator with Miles Davis for his early work in the late 40s and 50s. So happy birthday to Jerry, and best wishes to Miles, impersonated in the persona of Wellesley Robertson III. And Jean Cocteau is Olivier Normand. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Track from Miles Ahead. Miles ahead of his time indeed, Miles Davis. Needles and Opium at ACT here in San Francisco, act-sf.org, now through April 23rd. Such a pleasure to talk with these incredibly creative guys. Music of Tchaikovsky from his septet that will be heard in full orchestral splendor by the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra. Martin West standing by to correct me on some of my facts on that. A pleasure to welcome him back to our airwaves. Surprised that his arms still aren't waving from all the productions you've been conducting this ballet season.
Oh,
stop it already. Calm down a little bit, would you? You look silly.
Sorry, I'm tired, yeah, but they keep going. They can't stop, I'm afraid. So you said septet, it's sextet.
Sextet, all right, but it will be the full orchestra. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have, 2,500 people in the opera house, so I think, six players doesn't really...
Well, you've done things with solo.
No, we have, yeah.
Before and
but,
smaller.
It's a very huge house, but the adding the weight of the strings just really makes it...
Sure. And that's going to be for a work called, not septet or full orchestra, but trio.
Trio, yeah.
Choreographed by the great Helgi Thomasson. Tell us about that piece.
It's a beautiful ballet that Helgi did about 5 years ago. So this is kind of a second go through for us. He called it trio. Well, I assume he called it trio for two reasons. One is that the central movement is for trio dancers. It's a beautiful pas de trois. And he split the four movements into three sections. So it's kind of a trio of dances that he did.
This is a program of all new works, and the program itself is called Made for SF Ballet.
Yes, we have three different works. They were all made within the last 10 years. The oldest is only 9 years old, by Christopher Wheeldon, Within the Golden Hour, which is a piece we've done many times, been very, very popular. It's one of our most successful commissions and ballets that we performed all over the world. And we have Trio, as you say, and the brand new work which just premiered last night by our own Miles Thatcher.
Nice. Well, it's always nice to bring, and exciting to bring new works to life. I mean, speaking of new work to life, you recently brought, pun intended, the Lowell Lieberman score of the visually stunning Frankenstein to our ears.
That was amazing. Yeah, we brought that to life. We killed him off too, as well. No, that was really exciting. We've done a lot of new work this year. We've done two completely world premiere pieces of music as well. So the orchestra have been busy learning lots of new music this year. It's been a lot of fun.
And this particular program, Program 7, incorporates both the old and the new, the Tchaikovsky. There's also Vivaldi involved.
Yeah, it's amazing how these choreographers pick music. You know, I've never been very good at it myself. I always think this would be a great piece to choreograph, and no one ever wants to do it. And then these choreographers find this music. Interesting that, like, the Tchaikovsky's, it's by Tchaikovsky, but it's not a particularly well-known piece of Tchaikovsky. It's not played that often. As a sextet, it's not a particularly usual group of instruments to get together. So it's usually done on special occasions. So it's really fantastic that we can play this. It's a late masterpiece, but we get to play it so many times and really get to get in the...
Dig into it and
really think about it. And because it's been back with us for a couple of times now, we can really explore more deeply, and it's wonderful to play.
Is that possible to use those same descriptives for the contemporary music that you're doing, the Basso and the Nyman?
As if we dig into it more?
Yeah.
We'll find out. The Nyman's very new, so we'll see how that comes. And Nyman is very minimalist. I mean, he actually coined the term minimalist. Yeah, did you know that?
I
didn't know that until I started looking. So in the 1960s...
Hopefully he copyrighted it, too.
Well, if he'd had. Well, he made enough money, it's fine. He doesn't need to. His records sell. he's an incredibly successful guy. His music is very minimalist. So in a sense, there isn't that much to find in it. It's just very invigorating music. And I think that's why choreographers like it.
we've been asked if we can do another ballet next year to some of his music by another choreographer. So it's going to be, I think we might see more of his music in the future as well as people get to know it.
And the third batch of works is within the Golden Hour with music, as I mentioned, by Vivaldi and Bosso.
Ezio Bosso, yeah. Well, I don't know too much about him. He's an Italian, and he's a double bass player. And he's written quite a lot of works now. Most of ones I've heard have been for strings. He obviously writes really well for string groups. And I think the music that we play for Golden Hour was originally for sort of film music, I think. And it came to us in a very strange way. It was Christopher Wilden came to choreograph us for our last New Works Festival back in 2008. And he told me he was going to do some French songs by Henri Dupart. And we had it all lined up. And then after 2 days of choreographing, Chris turned around and said, "I'm sorry, this isn't going to work out. I need to change. It's just not going to work for me, this. I'd like to do this music." And all he had was this tape by Ezio Bosso. And so we had to do a lot of scrambling around and trying to find it, and these parts came and they didn't really match what was on the tape and all these things. But so my librarian Matt and I sat down and kind of worked it all out. And
Well, you mentioned for the Tchaikovsky you can beef it up with the full string section. Now with the Vivaldi, do you have to maybe calm them down a little bit?
We use fewer players for that. It's basically it's a slow movement of a violin concerto. So our concertmaster Cord Lemerx plays the concerto part, and so we cut down to just a very small section of strings, make it very intimate, and it's a great foil for the last piece in the ballet, which is this very exuberant piece for in a very fast five time called "I Was Born Under the Stars." It's very exciting.
Well, let's hear a little of that beautiful Andante of Vivaldi, and then more with Martin West of the San Francisco Ballet. Beautiful music of Vivaldi and Andante that will be choreographed by Christopher Wheeldon as part of his work Within the Golden Hour, conducted by Martin West, my guest here on Open Air. Martin, that's going to be beautiful. What will we see?
Well, the ballet itself is for, I think it's 14 dancers. There's three main couples and four girls and four boys, but Each couple has their own little pas de deux, and that's the final pas de deux. This is an absolutely gorgeous pas de deux. And Chris, the music, the rest of the music by Bosso is kind of Vivaldi-esque, a modern version of Vivaldi-esque. There's certainly similarities, which is why it all works together very well.
I hear a little bit of Nyman almost too, in terms of a slightly minimalist approach. You could call Vivaldi the original minimalist.
I guess so.
To an extent,
nothing's new in music, is it? You know?
Well, the April 18th, 7:30 performance of Made for SF Ballet will be a farewell performance for principal dancer Lorena Feijou.
Feijou.
Added to the program will be a pas de deux from Liam Scarlett's Hummingbird, which Lorena will perform with a partner, and a video tribute.
Yeah, more minimalist. Actually, we're looking at adding one more as well, one more piece.
Great. And then just four more productions of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, including another farewell performance of Vanessa Zahorian and David Karapetyan on the final night, Saturday the 15th.
Yeah, that'll be a sad farewell.
Yeah, David. I mean, I come to the ballet for the music, I'm just starting to discover the subtleties and the virtuosity of the dancers involved. It's been a pleasure to discover.
They're amazing athletes. I mean, it's not just athletes, of course, they're artists, but they couldn't do it without being incredible athletes as well. I think we forget that sometimes. But Vanessa's been in the company for 20 years, and David's arrived when I came, so he's been probably 12 years. And so huge loss to the company.
Wow. And then on the onto the fantastic score of Prokofiev's Cinderella starting April 28th.
Amazing. Can't wait.
Is there anything that is more fun than the ballet score of Prokofiev for everyone involved?
I think we all love playing Cinderella. I was just thinking, I did it first time 20 years ago, and every single time it comes back, I can't wait to do it. It's just fantastic music. It's very difficult as well, by the way.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Much more difficult than Romeo and Juliet.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
It's more clever, and so once you get to know it, it becomes relatively easy, but nothing... Romeo and Juliet's all there on the heart sleeve, and it's all obvious kind of how it goes, but the Cinderella's just kind of... If you don't know the whole score, you just look at your part, you think... What's this for? But it's
intricate stuff.
Yeah, it's very intricate. Yeah. It's very so great.
I have to have you on to talk about that more then when that one comes around. Yeah. And I mentioned that the Michael Nyman piece includes one of the more famous tunes that he's written for from the piano.
I like that. More famous. It's incredibly famous.
Yeah. The Heart Asks Pleasure First, Michael Nyman. Music that will be incorporated into the world premiere of New Thatcher with choreography by Miles Thatcher. Martin, thanks so much for coming in today.
You're
and
very welcome.
Looking
thanks
forward
so
to seeing the program.
Me.
We'll see you soon.
See you soon.
Famous music by Michael Nyman being incorporated into New Thatcher, the world premiere with choreography by Miles Thatcher as part of the Made for SF Ballet Productions, Program 7 of the SF Ballet. Information about remaining tickets, sfballet.org. Well, the San Francisco Film Festival is officially underway. Programmer Rod Armstrong and filmmaker Travis Matthews join me in studio to talk about what's to come and what happened last night, perhaps, at the wonderful opening that I had to miss. Rod, welcome.
Thank you.
So how did last night go?
Last night was terrific. We had, according to the box office, perhaps 4 seats that were unoccupied in the lovely Castro Theater.
Wow.
And so a rousing cheer of approval for the film. We had special guests, Jenny Slade, some of the producers on the film, the actress Abby Quinn. And then we had a great party over at the Regency Center with a fantastic band and lots of people dancing, folks enjoying themselves.
That's what I should have crashed after I went to ACT.
Absolutely.
And Travis, I imagine you were a part of that as well last night?
I was. I managed to go to the film, which I enjoyed a lot, and I can say firsthand that there were 4 seats or less at the Castro. I didn't make it to the party, but I did really enjoy the film.
Nice. So, Rod, give us a couple of highlights. One thing that always is a challenge for someone approaching a catalog of a film festival is the sheer volume that's involved.
Mm.
Give us a way to pick and choose to guide us into what we should catch.
Sure.
Usually, for me, it's what I can see when,
right,
rather than what I want to see.
Yeah, I mean, that's a piece of it. You decide, oh, I want to see some films on Saturday. What's on? The other ways that we have are basically organizing the program into sections. So we have Live and On Stage for if people want to see live one-of-a-kind events. We have marquee presentations, which are more perhaps oriented to films with recognizable talent in them, recognizable filmmakers, recognizable subject matter. We have, for people interested in experimental work, the Vanguard section. So that's another point of entry for people. Sometimes people will know particular directors and they can look them up by that. And we have the Masters section for really people that are internationally known.
Mm-hmm. Speaking on the international front, what were some interesting discoveries that are part of this year's festival?
Well, we noticed as we were kind of closing the schedule that Argentina had made several films that we were going to show in the festival, several really interesting films. So each year we have a World Cinema Spotlight, and it's been about everything from one year it was called Painting with Light, and this year it just happens to be Argentina, and so we got some wonderful film writers from Buenos Aires to write about the four films that we're showing and kind of how the cinema in Argentina has really reached a new plateau that will hopefully keep going and growing.
And those films are scattered throughout the festival.
They are, yeah. One of them is called The Winter. We have another one that's also partially set in New York called Hermia and Helena. We've got a debut feature called The Human Surge, and another one called The Future Perfect.
Nice. And all of the full catalog and ways to search for these films is at sffilm.org. Travis Matthews, so how did this film get your film Discreet get to be a part of this particular festival?
I don't know. That's probably more of a question for Rod than me.
It was chosen,
but
I guess. So you had to submit it?
I did have to submit it. You know, it's such a joy for me to have this film having our Bay Area premiere here with SF International, SF Film, as it's called now. Partly just because I've been here for 20 years. I've lived here for 20 years. I feel like I'm part of the filmmaker community. And the Film House and the Film Society and everybody's kind of become family to me. And so it feels really extra special for me to be having the film premiere at the Castro on Saturday.
No kidding. That's going to be something. We're going to have some tickets, actually, eight total. You can take them as a single or a duet to 415-841-4134. But before we offer the tickets, perhaps we should give us a synopsis of what they're going to see.
This movie, right? What is this movie?
Discreet.
So I directed a feature called Discreet. And, you know, I mean, I think the short sort of description of the movie is that it's kind of a minimalist thriller. It's a queer minimalist thriller. Takes place in rural Texas, about this drifter who comes home to make amends with his estranged mother, and in the process is kind of thrust into this trauma that still exists with him from his past. And when we made the film, it's important for me to share with people, when we wrote the film and made the film, it was during the election. And there's,
talk about trauma, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it kind of built in the DNA of this film is a lot of our response to the zeitgeist at the moment. We certainly didn't think we'd be living in a Trump America at this point. And so we made a film that was largely meant
to be. Let's make a correction there. I'm not living in the Trump America.
You know.
I know what you're saying. Yeah.
But we made a film that was almost a nightmare, cautionary kind of tale that was meant to be putting a button on a particular moment. I mean, we certainly, like most people, thought we'd be living in a Madam President era right now, and things would be different, which is what makes it so interesting to be having the film and to be out on the festival circuit, to have this opportunity to talk to people about the politics behind my film.
Mm. Tell us about your cast.
Amazing cast. A lot of local people from Austin, Texas. But the lead actor, Johnny Mars, it's funny. He's such an integral piece to the film, and he gives such a fantastic performance, but it's the way in which we were introduced for this project that was really funny, because I was basically working out a treatment for this and showing it to different producers, and everybody I showed it to was like, have you shown this to Johnny Mars? And he was somebody I didn't know at the time, but when we met, We met in Waco, Texas on a winter's day, which like kind of says it all from there.
Okay.
But when we met, it became very clear just in terms of like why he was going to be perfect for the project, both as the lead actor and as a producer on the film.
Fantastic. Yeah. We do have 8 tickets, which you can take as a single or a pair. It's being screened this Saturday at 9 p.m. at the Castro Theater, Travis Matthews' film Discreet, 415-841-4134. And if you've never been to a film festival screening at the Castro Theater, it's something you want to be a part of. Congratulations on that. So to what degree is Discreet autobiographical or not?
That's such an interesting question. I mean, it's autobiographical to the point that I grew up in rural Ohio, and this movie takes place in rural Texas. And as Johnny Marsh, the actor who plays the lead character, as he likes to say, we grew up in the same zip code, meaning like rural isolation is rural isolation. And so I was drawing on that quite a bit, and I was also drawing on what I was witnessing around rural Texas at the time, which is this emergence of this talk radio, alt-right, white supremacist kind of horror show. And I was curious about how gay men in rural America were dealing with that, how they were using that to, how it was influencing the ways in which they represent themselves, both publicly and privately. And so it became a story of me distilling these different kind of influences in the zeitgeist through this one character, which really harkens back to my childhood in some ways, growing up in rural Ohio, as much as it does rural Texas.
Interesting, interesting. Have you submitted this to other festivals as well? Is that what you do once you have the final product? And
we had our premiere at the Berlin Film Festival, Berlinale, which was a great honor for us.
Nice.
And then, you know, from there we played Guadalajara, and now we're here at Bay Area. We played Boston last week. Yeah, I think that we have a really interesting and healthy festival life in front of us with the movie.
Other things you're looking forward to yourself in this festival?
Yeah, I'm actually, one thing that's happening tonight is this screening of Citizen Kane, and William Randolph Hearst III is going to be there talking about his family's relationship to that film.
I think it's the first time there's a public forum with an actual Hearst relative.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh my
yeah.
gosh, everybody should
You can talk
go.
More about that, Rod.
Yeah, I mean, it was really exciting because Will is on our board, and it was a proposal made to him by Noah Callan, our executive director, as to whether he would be willing to talk about his family's relationship to Citizen Kane. And he agreed, so he's going to be in conversation with David Thompson, and then the film is going to show. I think it's going to be hopefully revelatory.
I should say, yeah. Well,
and timely.
And timely. Good point there. Boy,
it could
be instead of Citizen Kane, Citizen Breitbart or something. Rod Armstrong, programmer for the San Francisco Film Festival. Filmmaker Travis Matthews, thanks for coming in today. Travis's Discreet films at the Castro Theater this Saturday at 9 p.m. I think we might have a pair or two of tickets still available for those that call 415-841-4134. Thanks again for coming in, guys.
Thanks.
It was a pleasure.
More information about the festival at sffilm.org. Lots of great screenings happening now through the 23rd or so. sffilm.org. Open Air is produced by Neil Swinkles here at KLW, who also manages our calendar. If you've got a show segment idea, send me an email, david@kalw.org. And all of our shows are archived at our website, www.kalw.org. See you next week.